All right, quick bit of history. There's Nero, and then there was a period for 18 months, very quick transitions where there was a new emperor and the death of that emperor. There were four. Until we finally get to this guy named Vespasian. And this is a wonderful likeness of him that someone had made way back when. But as we talk about Vespasian, this is what we need to understand is Jewish wars and revolts against Rome, and this is about as much background as we need to know going into this, began in about 66. And there was all sorts of factions that were even fighting amongst themselves inside Jerusalem. So the Jews were actually fighting against the Jews. It was like a civil war kind of a thing. And by the time we get to the destruction of Jerusalem, what's a very wonderful tactic? If you're going to try to waste away the enemy with time, what are you going to cut away from their supply? Their food and water, right? By the time we get to Jerusalem, most of the grain storage has been burned and depleted. That's really important to consider here. But here's the other aspect, is there was also civil war going on in Rome. And when you continue to have leaders come up and die and come up and die, there's going to be struggles for power, and that's what led to this civil war. Here's the big irony. This is the Lex Talionis factor for this. The Jews kind of signed their own death warrant. And here's how. They began all these revolts against Rome. And so Rome sent down this man named Vespasian to come down and to deal with the Jews. And he made a great name for himself as he went down through Judea. He also had a commanding son named Titus who was at Alexandria. Now, as Vespasian is going down and winning all these wars and making a name for himself, they decide that they need a new emperor over Rome. Guess who they elect? They elect him. He becomes the new emperor. And Rome was, the only reason that Vespasian was down was dealing with the Jews. Had the Jews not been revolting, Rome would have possibly continued in civil war and perhaps torn itself apart in many ways when you look at what was going on. But because the Jews created an opportunity for him to make a name for himself, he comes back, restores peace, and guess where all of Rome's focus then becomes on? On the Jews and on Jerusalem. So we're going to pick up with him sending his son Titus down. And Titus is going to come up from Alexandria, as we're going to see. He's going to stop in Caesarea, and he's going to start having all these armies that are being surrounding to him and rallying to him. How many of you are really confused by typographical maps, by the way? Because that's me. All right. Here is, yeah, go ahead. Right. We're gonna get there in just a minute, but that's, we'll go ahead and talk about it now, because now it's good as ever. When Vespasian leaves, and you start to see the armies closing in on Jerusalem, remember the Lord's warnings in Matthew 24 and all the signs? And he says, when you see these things, what should you do? You get out. And the Christians that adhered to the warnings of Christ all fled. And we're going to see it's primarily Jews that are left in the city. And it's really terrible, but we're going to see there's about 97,000 that are taken captive and over a million that are killed and slaughtered in the city. And if there were Christians in the city, they would have been in that mix. They would either have been sold as slaves, taken captive, or they would have been killed in the city, burned alive or crucified. Yeah, Marvin. You know, that's quite the claim that I don't know you can have any evidence for. All I would say is historically, if a Christian didn't get out of the city like Christ warned them to, they're in trouble. And I would actually argue that there would be a great chance that they perished if they didn't heed Christ's warnings. But that being said, those that left, they probably wouldn't have perished. They would have been alive, and that's why Christ warned them. Here's a really basic model. Here's the city. This is the third wall. We're going to see another map here. There were three walls within Jerusalem for defense. Okay? There's the third wall, the second wall, and the first wall, which is the innermost wall that surrounds the Temple Mount and the upper city, which is actually south for us. Remember, upper is all in terms of elevation. Here's how these maps make sense. You see the really, really close squiggly lines? That means very steep. That means high elevation. So when you look at the Temple Mount, actually, it was nearly impossible to attack from three fronts. Where would you attack looking at this map? Where would be the only place that you had opportunity to attack from? Right here. As you're looking at this section right here and right up here, the northwest side of the city, and that's exactly where Rome is going to begin their siege. Okay. Now, that being said, they're still going to put some Legion 10 on the Mount of Olives up here, just in case they could cross over. But let's go ahead and jump into this. I'm not going to do a lot of teaching tonight, by the way. We're going to do a lot of reading, just because we want to historically understand what was taking place then. But these marks up here, these are all a reference to where you'll find it in Josephus' Book of Wars of the Jews, by the way. So for your own reference later, if any of one of you, I've got two books on Josephus and one on my computer, so if two of you want to borrow it and read it, then come see me afterwards and you can look at exactly what he says. But here in early 70 or late 69, Vespasian goes back up to Rome and he sends Titus to finish this work. And so he has 2,000 with him and 3,000 more that are Euphrates guards. And what we're going to see is eventually he's joined by 4,000 more Roman legions. And so grand total, he's got some 9,000 troops that are trained, highly efficient Roman soldiers that are going to surround the city. And when they surround the city, they're going to be met, actually, Rome is actually outnumbered drastically. When you look at the number of troops in Jerusalem and the number of people in Jerusalem. But that generally doesn't matter sometimes in a war. If you've got the best technology, you've got the upper hand, you've got the right weaponry, then you're going to win out. But there are actually two factions that are still arguing over space in Jerusalem. One of them is this gentleman named John, who is actually a rival of Josephus. He defeated the zealots, and remember, we read one of the apostles was a zealot, wasn't he? What was a zealot, by the way? Anyone remember? A sect? What was their whole gig?
Well, they wanted to reestablish David's kingdom.
Right. And they thought they would do that by force. They were kind of like Jewish terrorists against the Romans. That's the best way to kind of describe them. There was a lot of coups and trying to overthrow Roman dignitaries and powers. But the zealots are defeated, and John gains control of the most important and prominent place, the inner court and the temple. Simon, the son of Gioras, who is a popular leader, he has 15,000 soldiers that are with him. John has 6,000 plus 2,400 of the Eleazars, the zealots, that surrendered and said, okay, we're going to work for you. So a lot of soldiers are at play here. But anyhow, as Titus approaches the city, he begins by leveling all the gardens, all the walls, all the plantations, all the suburbs that are outside that third wall, because they're going to start building these earthen kind of barriers to protect themselves so they can begin ramming the wall and trying to break loose the wall so they would move their camp from the third wall into the second wall in the lower part of the city. And so he moves his legions, he leaves one on the Mount of Olives, and he moves three more about a fourth of a mile outside of the tower of Sphinius. And the reason you would be that far out, by the way, is missiles then, artillery, big rocks, that were about 75 pounds each, they could be thrown just about a quarter of a mile, okay? So you would actually stay back, you know, about that distance so anything would fall just short of where you were. You wouldn't get slammed with rocks in the middle of the night. But here's a better map. This is where Titus is. They're going to come in right here. And then they're going to bring this troop in behind them as well. And we're going to see they're actually going to come up eventually. They're going to break through the second wall and start attacking the fortress of Antonia and trying to get to the upper city right over here. Because right here is the Mount, the Temple Mount. This is the temple right here. If you can break the Antonian fortress and get through, then the Temple Mount is yours. So this is the Roman plan. And this is where he sets up. Both sides begin artillery fire. Here you go. So it's 1/4 mile, 370 meters, that you could throw these stones. There were 75 pounds. Here's the problem. They were big and white. So even in the middle of the night, you could still see them and you'd be able to warn people about artillery that was coming in. And it's coming from both sides. The Romans were smart. Guess what they did? They painted them black. So they weren't able to see where they were coming from. And you imagine Goliath had a headache after he got hit with a rock. Remember, Luke Chandler was showing us the real size of those rocks the slingers used were probably actually about 10 pounds. They were the size of a baseball. Imagine something 75 pounds coming through and hitting the wall and just the alarming sound that would be or coming through the city. So shots are being fired on both sides. And they quickly begin to build their ramps, and the Romans bring in their battering rams. And these would have been trees that have been fashioned with metal tips and all these different things. And soldiers would run them and they would just ram it into the wall over and over again at special places to try to break the walls apart. Sometimes they would even dig under the wall to try to create a weakness within the wall before they started the ramming process. Yeah. Right, right. And so it was just this amazing contraption. The Romans were far ahead of their time as far as technology goes. I heard another state.
The Antonia Fortress, it wasn't occupied by Roman soldiers at this time?
Because of the battles that were already taking place within the city, they had been removed from there and pulled back. So
that's where they were. Usually.
Right, normally. That's correct. Mm-hmm. All right. But when the war started, they kicked him out. So one of the generals is killed in this very first drive, actually. But the rams begin, and they're actually, after 15 days, imagine how thick those walls were. 15 days of ramming these walls until they finally broke through. And so they break through the wall, and I don't want to use this reference, but I think it's a great reference. You know, in Lord of the Rings, whenever someone finally makes a breach through a door or a wall, what are they immediately hit with when you watch those movies? There's just swords and arrows and just a barrage waiting for them. And so this isn't like, hey, we're through the wall, everyone go ahead and come through. This is massive hand-to-hand bloody combat we're talking about here. There would have been floods of arrows flying through on both sides. As they're trying to get through. And so they raise a large part of the wall, actually. Once they can get part of it down, they flatten the rest of it because now you can come from all sorts of different angles into that section. If there's just a small area, that's easy to defend. But as they start working on other sections of the wall and knocking it over, now the Romans have the advantage and the Jews have to retreat. And so the Romans move their camp to the inside of that second wall. They don't have access to the Antonia fortress yet, but they're going to start working on that right away. The second wall, they begin work on, and they have much better success. They're actually able to breach the second wall in 5 days. Not 15 days, but 5 days. Part of that's because the third wall was built larger than the second wall. Those were for last primary defenses. But they breached through it, and they start to flood into the market district. But most of the Roman soldiers actually were severely wounded. They were not prepared to advance after they had breached the wall. So Titus has to pull back, and they're just going to stop there. The wall is breached. The Roman soldiers have taken a big loss, and so they're going to pull back and regroup. And at this point, actually, Titus does something really interesting. He's going to spread out all of his legions across about a quarter mile back. Why would you do something like that? Why would you spread out all your armies in a big line, kind of like the Redcoats did in Britain?
Well, you've got to defend a large line.
All right. You have to defend a large line. Think psychologically. The people are now looking at what they've got coming their way. And the purpose of that kind of a tactic is to scare the enemy into surrendering or fleeing, because Titus tried to get peaceful negotiations to happen more than once, and the Jews rejected it. Yeah?
Well, we got to remember, too, that this has been going on for a long time.
Right. Right.
Jerusalem had its own water source as well.
Right.
Dried up during this
time. Right. And
the they didn't have a lot
to it. Josephus believes it's God's providence and acts of judgment against Jerusalem. The Pool of Siloam was dried up until the Roman soldiers took control of that area, and then within that month it filled back up, which is really, really interesting. But that being said, on June 4th, they're finally going to take down the entire wall, and they're just going to flatten it. And so their next goal here is they're going to try to actually attack from two fronts. And if you'll look in that picture, in that handout you have of the city, it's back a page from where we're at now. They've got one encampment there at the Antonia Fortress, and then one kind of at the corner where that first wall is. And they're going to try to attack from two fronts to try to get up onto the Temple Mount and gain control of the temple. Because Titus didn't want to destroy the temple. Think about that. If you're a Roman, what's in that temple? All sorts of loot. And you want to keep that, okay? So they're trying to tactfully get up there in a way that they could gain control and that things will not be destroyed in a particular fashion. Yeah, Bruce?
Military-wise, any offensive group going against a defensive group has about a 4-to-1 or 6-to-1 advantage.
Right.
It takes 6 offensive to defeat one defensive
group. Right.
So you're dealing with a major
effort. Right.
Major effort.
Right. This is a huge effort. They're going to build these fortresses and these earthworks is what they're called, and they were just these makeshift walls that they would build themselves to turn into ramps and also to protect themselves from artillery fire as they were trying to build more trying to bring in the battering rams. Here's the problem. We're going to see that there is a particular Jew that comes out, and somehow he's like James Bond. He comes out, he burns down an entire tower and fortress of the Romans that was 50 feet tall, destroys their whole system, their battering system, and they're going to have to regroup their strategy and refocus all their strategy. So the Jews have a big plus. So this is what Titus decides to do. He decides we're going to cut off all food supply, all different things, and we're just going to starve the people. We're going to wait it out. This is where it starts to get really, really bad and really depressing and really messy. It says, although Josephus with his tears thus loudly appealed to them, the insurgents do not yield. However, non-combatants are inspired to desert, and they sell their possessions for gold and then swallow the gold coins to hide themselves to escape from the Romans. What we're going to see in just a minute, the Syrians caught on to that. And so as people tried to flee the city, they would rip open their stomachs alive and start to find gold. 2,000 people in one day was at one point, one count, where they just would throw them down, slash open their guts, and look for money. But that's what these people were trying to do, is they were trying to hide some money so they could get out and start over and leave. That wasn't going to happen. People started deserting and surrendering to become a prisoner, and they were bringing back reports. And the report they were bringing back was that if someone had a locked door, it meant they had food. So Jews would start to kick in their neighbor's door and grab their throats to force any food out of their throats they had so they could eat it themselves. In fact, one of the worst stories we're going to get to is one woman and her neighbor decide that they were going to kill her infant child, and she ate half of it one morning and gave the other half to her neighbor. This is what Jesus meant when he said, you better run. And you better hope it's not winter. And you better hope it's not on the Sabbath. Because some of the most atrocious things started to take place in the city as they were dying off of starvation. The wealthy were robbed and murdered by the forces of John and Simon. They are now the militant leaders of the city. It's not about saving the Jews, it's about saving themselves. They're going to, by force, take all the assets. And it goes on, and Josephus says, to narrate their enormities in detail is impossible. But to put it briefly, no other city ever endured such miseries, nor since the world began has there been a generation of more prolific in crime. That's exactly what Jesus said was going to happen. Josephus confirms it and says, I can't write about what's happening. But that kind of thing, cannibalism, eating their children, slashing open people's guts to try to get to food that they had just eaten and eat it yourself. That's the kind of thing that was going on in Jerusalem within the Jews amongst themselves. And so to try to terrify the people into surrender. And by the way, Josephus, who's the negotiator, several times that Titus is trying to make peace offerings, Josephus had some personal reasons why he wanted Jerusalem to surrender. His mother, his wife, and his brothers were all in the city. And as they're refusing to surrender, he knows that all of them are probably going to die. And so Josephus is, this, when we're reading what he's writing, you can only imagine his heartache as he's watching all this take place. And so as people tried to escape the city, not surrender, but escape, there'd be about 500 a day that were caught, and there would be mass crucifixions put up on the tops of those walls for all the city to see. Thousands of people, Jews, lined up bleeding to death and suffocating to death for the people to see. There were so many people that they ran out of crosses, and they ran out of places to put the crosses. There was just mass murder taking place here, okay? So great was their number that the space could not be found for crosses nor crosses for the bodies. Finally, the earthworks is destroyed. I'll go ahead and just read this. It says, on the 17th day of the building of the works, John undermines the Antonio earthwork, builds under it, built by the 5th Legion, and sets fire to the supporting timbers, causing the tunnels to collapse and the whole works to burn. This is what we alluded to earlier. 2 days later, Simon's men set fire to the other works and the battering engines, and the Roman soldiers are all dispirited at the loss of so much hard work and also the lack of timber to rebuild, get this, because all the trees around the city had been cut down for a distance of 90 stadia, that's 10 miles. So for them to continue their siege, they have to send soldiers out 10 miles, 15 miles, 20 miles, and bring all that lumber back and restart and hope it doesn't get destroyed. It's a long process, an exhausting process, even on the Romans' part. And so Titus, again, decides to starve the city. He goes back to that tactic. He has a consultation. They prevent any food supplies from entering. And what they do is they build a trench all around the city, and it takes 3 days to do it. And that would prevent anyone from being able to escape. They would just be stuck in a big, deep ditch if they tried to escape. And then they would just be shot, and that's how they would die. No promise of anyone surviving at this point. Burials were neglected. Bodies piled up in the city. and insurgents continued the trials of prominent persons to execute eminent men and imprisoned Josephus' father. He was in the city as well. But you can't even bury people. So many people are dying of starvation and plague in the city that they just would leave them on the street. You just have to step over dead people as you walk through the city. And as we're going to see, the death count was in the 1,100,000 range. Imagine a city in that space, and there's just 10, 15 bodies that were just stacked on top of each other, just dead people. That's what happened. This is the exact quotation or the reference. Syrian troops discovered some deserter had swallowed gold coins, and the rumor spread so that all deserters were filled with gold, or so they thought. And so the Arabs and the Syrians cut open all who escaped the city, and in one night, no less than 2,000 were ripped open. And Josephus interprets this as another example of divine retribution. But this was a nightly occurrence. Not as many as 2,000 sometimes, but every night they'd just rip people open and try to find money because they thought they might have had money in them. It goes on. By the time we're here, almost to July, the deserter Manius ben Lazarus is assigned by the Romans to watch the city gate. He counts 115,880 bodies that are carried through the gate during the siege. And in the period of Xanthicus the 14th to Panemus the 1st, May 1st to July 20th, reports from within the city give a total dead among the lower classes at 600,000. Over a 500,000 people that are just laying around and being thrown out of the city. That's how many people died. They finally rebuild the earthworks, and they decide we need to focus on our efforts on one section, the Romans do. And they're just going to focus on the Tower of Antonia. And we're going to protect this lumber because now it's more valuable than ever. Because now if they destroyed that earthwork and those battering rams, how far would Rome have to go get timber? You know, 30 miles, you know, 25, 30 miles. So they come back, they focus all their efforts here. The Jews try to destroy it again, but they're not successful this time. And so they bring in siege engines under the tower. They finally collapse part of the wall, and then they're really, really frustrated because as soon as they collapse part of the wall to the tower, guess what the Jews have wisely done behind that wall? They've built another one in the process. And so now they've got to get through a fourth wall, thinking they would only have to get through three. But finally, actually, this is an amazing story. 24 soldiers, without prompting, without instruction, decide, we're going to be like David's mighty men. We're going to go get this job done. This was like the SEAL Team 6 for the Romans, okay? They go through, and they attack and seize Antonia, and they're able to drive back, actually, the Jews all the way back to the temple grounds in that area. And so they take Antonia, but they aren't able to go any further. But they're finally able to take that wall that had been put up by the Jews there. This is an amazing thing that happens here. Before this, I want to share a comment. This is how far the Jews were. To the Jews, what was the most sacred and wonderful thing in the city? The temple. Beforehand, Titus is trying to negotiate peace because he wants the temple, but they don't want the Romans to have the temple. And the comment back was, the temple of this earth is greater than for you to possess the temple of God. They were willing to allow the temple to be devastated and desolated before the Romans got their hands on it. So what happens next, though, is now these, you know, Jewish and some Gentile Jewish leaders that have desecrated the temple are now in the temple grounds, and so the priests stop sacrifices. That hadn't happened since they had rebuilt the temple several hundred years before. This is an incredible thing for the temple sacrifices to end. And Josephus actually makes a plea with John to restore the sacrifices. There's this amazing dialogue where he tells them, he says, John delivers a message from Titus to the rebels within hearing of all the populace. John may leave the temple so that it will no longer be polluted. and that the sacrifices may be restored. John enters into a heated argument with Josephus, John stating that the city was God's so it could never be captured. Wasn't that what the people were crying out before to the days of Jeremiah? The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Josephus has a lengthy monologue where he says, I identify with Jeremiah. I understand how he felt as he's writing these things. And Josephus replied to John that he had driven the divine presence away by stopping the sacrifices. Actually, it had happened a long time before that. John is unmoved, but a great number of upper-class citizens, especially the priests, desert at this point to the Romans because the priests think, if we're not offering sacrifices, God's not on our side. We've got no shot. So they go surrender and become prisoners to the Romans. Yeah. Oh, I thought you had your hand up. Okay. All right. That's where the battle for the temple starts. There was one large battle to begin with, and it was kind of a draw. No one gained any ground anywhere. And so the Romans kind of go back to their place. The Judeans kind of pull back to their place. Josephus records a number of the Judean heroes that made that possible and some that died in the process. But finally, they get wise, the Romans. And so they build several embankments to the first wall on that map you've got. And at the northwest corner of the inner temple, and one at the northern hall between the two gates, and one opposite the west portico to the outer court, and one opposite the north portico. Here's the point. Now they're coming from four different directions, okay? Four sections. Is that hard to defend against when they're coming against four angles? So that's their next move. And this is where it gets really bad, because as this is going on, remember, they still have no food. Jerusalem is still starving to death. And so victims of famine are dying in countless number. Hungry rebels like mad dogs stagger from house to house searching for food. They actually started to eat shoe lather and grass, just eating whatever they could put in their mouth to try to fill their stomachs with some kind of substance. The tale of Mary, the daughter of Eleazar, is one that Josephus writes, "For fear of being regarded as a fabricator, I would gladly have omitted this tragedy. Had I not innumerable witnesses among my contemporaries." And that was the woman who started eating her own child and sharing her child with other women. And when Titus hears it, he is so repulsed that he vows, I'm just going to destroy everything. Imagine that. The Roman legionnaire, right, the Roman soldier, is repulsed by the actions of the Jews who are supposed to be the people of God. And he says, I'm just going to destroy everything. I don't care anymore. I'm just going to level everybody, the whole place. But he decides now, let's try to burn them out. So he sets the temple gates on fire. But the problem was, this actually led to a big slaughter of the Romans as well. It says, now that Titus saw that his endeavor to spare a foreign temple led only to injury and slaughter of his troops, because they'd been trying to raise these ladders and get it to where they could surround it and take control, and they were just losing soldiers right and left. He says, let's just burn it. So he orders the gate set on fire. The silver melts and the fire enters the woodwork and spread to the porticos. And after a day, Titus orders the fire extinguished and a road built to the gates for the ascent of the legions. But the fire continued to burn. And that's when two of Simon's officers decided to give up, and they went over to the Roman side. Titus consults with everyone, says, what do we do at this point? They decide, let's still try to save the temple. And so that's the decision they come to. But one of the Roman soldiers doesn't listen. And as they're attacking the Temple Mount and they're getting closer, Titus withdraws back to Antonia. The rest of them are forced into the inner court, the Jews, after a battle for 3 hours. And then when they attack again, one of the soldiers takes a burning timber and he throws it through the golden door on the north side into the chambers of the temple and the surrounding area. And it catches the outside on fire. And finally then, Titus goes in to try to extinguish the fire himself. And as it's written by Josephus, he actually entered the Holy of Holies, found it empty. But one of the other soldiers took torches and started lighting things on fire inside the temple. And he's in the holy place. And so now the whole thing begins to burn. And the whole temple was on fire. And so as Josephus records it, thus against Caesar's wishes, the temple was set on fire. And the eyewitness accounts, which is really interesting, is he says, "You would have indeed thought that the temple hill was boiling over from its base, being everywhere one mass of flame, yet the stream of blood was more copious than the flames." He's trying to describe the scene. He says, "There, everywhere you look, there's fire. But to make it even more descriptive, imagine there's more blood, and that's how much blood there is in fire. There's this fire, everything's burning, and there's this blood running through the streets everywhere. People are burning alive." And this is what caught my attention. This is on the month, as the Jews would call it, Lewis, the 10th. It would be our August 29th. Here's what's really interesting. Now, whether this is God's providence or what, I don't know. But the day that the temple is burned with fire and destroyed is the exact same day on the Jewish calendar that the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. Exactly the same day. So whether that is coincidence or not, I don't know. But that says a lot to me about God's providence on his statement of that this is his judgment upon the Jews. It was his judgment the first time, they knew it, and on the exact same day, the exact same month, it happens again, and it's God's judgment a second time. The temple finally is completely consumed, and then they start burning people alive. The Romans burned all the buildings in the temple complex, destroying the treasure chambers of wealth. And the populace, especially the poor women and children, are persuaded by a false prophet, which Jesus said would happen, remember, to go up to the temple court to receive deliverance from God. And a crowd of about 6,000 climb onto the porticos, and then the Romans set it on fire. And all of them burned alive, 6,000 people. I want you to imagine the smell, too, as you're there. Just the blood running through the streets and people burning and the hair burning. This is atrocious. This is Holocaust times five kind of stuff that's taking place here. Not to demise what took place there, but Jesus meant it. There was nothing else that's happened like this. Roman sacrifices, this is the complete desecration. After they put the fire out somewhat, the Romans then carried their gods into the temple through the east gate, and they started offering to their gods in God's house in the temple. And they had taken all the gold and tried to take as much gold as they could. And they took so much gold, even though a lot of it had been melted down and burned, that the price of gold actually was halved through Syria. That's how much gold was on the temple and in Jerusalem. Yeah.
Going back to the fires, that's also the prophecies about the sun being, literally the sun being blotted out and so forth.
Right.
Smoke. Darkness.
You couldn't see anything. Right. Right.
Very dark at night.
Right. Because it's just so much smoke. It's like when St. Helens. Right. Yeah, that's what's going on here. All the priests that hadn't deserted already, Titus just slaughters them on the spot as he enters the temple. He just kills all the priests. He tries to get the city to surrender. They don't. And so he orders the final siege, and that is the siege of the upper city. And they just burn and sack everything. Everything's burned to a crisp. Every section, every wall is broken down except for two different towers, as we're going to see. And here's what they did with everybody. The chiefs of the Idumeans send emissaries to surrender to Titus, but Simon discovers the plot and executes the conspirators. There are masses of deserters over to the Romans, most of whose lives were spared by Titus. Over 40,000 captured citizens were released by the Romans, but the rebels, including women and children, were sold as slaves. Due to the excess of supply, they were priced low. So you can sell the rebels, those who were fighting back, really cheap. And they sold 40,000 of them into slavery. One of the priests actually stole a bunch of the valuable things in the temple and presented them as a gift in exchange for his life to Titus. And that's where that famous picture of the Romans carrying the menorah out came from, and probably from this gentleman, priest Jesus, or Jesus ben Thabuthai. And he gave him two candelabra, or menorah, solid gold, massive tablets, bowls, platters, veils, and high priest garments, which, remember, they had those plates in the front with all the precious stones that were in them. Very valuable things. And then the temple treasurer gave him more, including clothing and incense. They did that in exchange for their life, and they were all incorporated into the Temple of Pierce that was built in Rome. Finally, the upper city is destroyed. All of Rome is sacked after 18 days of fighting against the upper side. And this is the final thing. Two more slides, I think. Everyone in Jerusalem is made a prisoner. Any that are armed are put to death, as are the old and feeble, because you have no use for them. They just killed them. Fronto is appointed to determine the fate of the rest. He's someone who is appointed by Rome. Josephus writes about him quite a bit. Those under the age of 17 are sold. The strong are sent to work camps, and others to the games, the Colosseum, to go compete, because they're strong enough to give the Romans entertainment, so they'd just die a different way. This is the final total. After the war, there were 97,000 prisoners taken and 1,100,000 Jews left dead on the ground. And Simon and John are both captured. John is sentenced to life in prison, and that wasn't with benefits and TV and all those things. This is Roman prison. He probably wished he'd have gotten Simon's sentence, and that was Simon was executed at the triumph in Rome. When they would parade them through the city about how they destroyed Jerusalem, they would execute him in front of all the people, and they'd rejoice, is how he would have died. They set fire to everything else, all the outlying quarters. Titus orders the city and the temple to be razed to the ground. They just flatten everything. They just leave the tallest towers and a small portion of the wall to the west, which is still there. And that's it. Sorry. Really. This class was intended to enlighten us as to what you're reading about in Revelation, what the Lord is warning about. And for us to take this statement seriously, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. We need to be very careful about the way in which we serve God, because the last thing we want to do is fall into His judgment as well. Any last thoughts or questions? Yeah, Rochelle. Right. Right. And the irony of it being during the Passover in which God delivered his people. Right. That's when they rejected the Passover lamb.